and welcome to the Hashtag Angels podcast, where we bring you conversations about the latest tech trends with the people inventing and shaping them. I'm Jessica Varelli, and this week I'm joined by my co-host, Jana Messerschmidt.
When every investor is in sell mode, you're like, oh, I'm going to do the world. And then I think the reality is founders oftentimes are disappointed when people don't actually pull through.
We sit down with the founder of WorkLife VC, Brianne Kimmel.
I think it takes a little while to get into a good groove where you've seen enough companies to have a really strong sense for like, this is my shot.
We talk about Brianne's path to building an early stage fund that stands out in the ecosystem, advice for how to get started investing, and how she manages her time, including working the outbox. All right, let's get started. Brianne, thanks for hanging out with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been watching and collaborating with you as you've been building WorkLife, and there's so much to dig in there. But let's just start with a little bit of your background and what inspired you to create WorkLife.
I started WorkLife back in September of 2019, which feels like forever ago or a lifetime ago, especially considering we've spent the last 12 months at home. The vision has always been how do you make work more creative, more flexible, and more human? Not just for people that work in tech. I think there was this early misconception that we only invested in SaaS companies, which I do love workplace productivity. And I do love, you know, many of the investments that we've made in tools for remote teams. But I get super excited about the future of small business and, you know, directionally how easy it's become to start something. And this is something that we have seen during COVID. You know, I was reading a study that said that more small businesses have been started this quarter than any other quarter in U.S. history. And like, that's a really big, impressive number. And so we are seeing that, you know, as an early investor in a company called Webflow, they make it really easy for people to not only build websites with no code, but actually clone websites from amazing designers. And so it's become really easy to create your own place on the internet, whether you're selling your own, you know, merch lines or creating content or starting a startup. Many startups are built on Webflow. It's just been great to see just the breadth of what people are starting. And this last year has been a really hard time for a lot of people, but we're also seeing really amazing innovations specifically for restaurants and small businesses and internet creators, and all types of people have been really creative.
Yeah. Did you guys see that tweet from Patrick Collison of Stripe? I think it was last week, but he tweeted that more businesses have launched on Stripe since the beginning of 2020 than did in the rest of Stripe's history before that. And I think Stripe was founded in like 2009, 2010. So it just like is such a testament, Brianne, to everything that you're saying and seeing of just this boom of entrepreneurialism. It's so cool to see.
One thing that I've been thinking a lot about and spending a lot of time on is restaurants, because restaurants got hit so, so hard during COVID. But there have been some really interesting innovations where we've seen, you know, the ability for anyone to start their own food truck or to start as a stall at a farmer's market. And so this like shift to outdoors has been really interesting because it's actually reduced restaurants' reliance on real estate, which is really expensive. And, you know, I think increasingly less modern because people are working from home. And so they want food delivered or, you know, I think especially after we've spent the last year at home, people want to get out and be outside and, you know, go to a food truck park or go to a farmer's market. And so it's been great to see that there are a lot of these new, I think Stripe's a great example. I mean, I know Square has done well over the last 12 months. I invested in a company called Cash Drop, which is like very simple mobile friendly payments. And so it's been great to see just the level of innovation that's coming on the payment side. And then also I know Jana, you and I are both really excited about physical goods as well. Like I've invested in a number of platforms that help anyone launch their own merch line, or I'm seeing on the restaurant side, you know, as a angel investor in a company called House, which is a low alcohol aperitif. And the restaurant project was awesome to see like David Chang at Momofuku releasing these cool branded, like beautiful bottles that are like equal parts, great drink for when you're hanging out at home, But also, like, just I think packaging is something that's increasingly awesome because people are spending more time at home, and it's great to see every new item that you have in your house is like Instagrammable and just adds to the decor.
Yeah. You know, I made a few investments in companies over the last few years in the food space. One of them is Chef, which I'm trying to remember, Bran, did you end up investing in that one?
I didn't invest in Chef, but I'm a huge fan.
Like, it's such a cool product. It empowers a whole new generation of food creators to be able to cook out of their home or out of commercial kitchens. And so during COVID, they saw a huge boom because you had all of these like line cooks and you had all these people who had all these new restrictions that they had to be at home. And then, you know, another one that I invested in is a company called Snack Pass. I'm trying to remember if you're in that one as well.
I know the team, but I'm not an investor now.
For some reason, I thought that you were in both of those. So I'm like, here we go.
I would love to be in both.
It does seem like if you're a traditional restaurant owner or if you're someone that already has distribution, it's been awesome to see just the level of innovation as far as launching in-home kits, or I've talked to restaurants that have accelerated their time to a cookbook. And it seems like people are getting really, really creative and launching these, like taking a more almost platform approach to how they think about building their small business, where they're launching new product lines, mm-hmm. like coming up with ways to sell globally, to really connect with their fans in an interesting way. On the other hand, what I love about a company like Chef is the fact that there are so many great cooks in the world that are just looking for that next step up. Like if you have traditionally worked at a restaurant and you're limited to a couple of shifts per week, if you have the ability to, you know, design your own menu, to experiment with new menu items and to really think very entrepreneurially, like you have uncapped potential in ways that when you are someone, you know, working for someone else, or if you have a traditional boss, like you're limited to the number of shifts that you have scheduled. And so I like these new business models where we're actually, you know, empowering highly skilled people with new ways for them to monetize their time.
You know, I think also like what's so interesting in the Chef example is we're so spoiled living in larger cities and even in the suburbs, you know, with things like DoorDash and Uber Eats. But I think about like where I grew up, which is a very rural part of the country. And there are tons of people with incredible baking and cooking skills. I mean, the practice kind of already exists. Like you sell your product at the church bake sale, you know, every month. But there's all of these like food deserts of great food because there's just not enough people to be able to have multiple restaurants or multiple different types of cuisine. And I think something like Chef could like really have a great impact in more of like the rural or, you know, kind of like the tier three, tier four types of smaller cities.
Brian, you mentioned like how you spend your time. I'd love to actually go a level deeper on that because there's so much incredible dynamism in the industry right now with solo GPs or emerging managers and new funds and different ways to think about investing and building a firm. And I think what you've done with Work Life, it sounds like you said it was fall 2019. So like a year and a half
yeah.
has really stood out. I feel like your thesis is known. You've identified a, you know, a specific kind of view in the market and love the content you put out too. Will you tell us a little bit more about how you spend your time or the philosophy underpinning what you want to build at Work Life and how you go about doing that?
To kick things off, what's interesting with the solo capitalist model is we're all quite different by design. So when I catch up with other solo capitalists, we all spend our time in different ways. Some are very outbound focused and, you know, really great at tracking down companies, and many are investing in between rounds and just getting very creative with how they view like building their portfolio. For Work Life in particular, the vision has always been to be very thematic in how we approach the world. And so whether that's taking a corporate setting and basically unpacking on a per team basis what needs to be built. So I might spend a whole week thinking about sales, like interviewing SDRs, AEs, CEOs of growth stage companies that are selling in the sales tech space. But to have a specialized firm and to do it well, we end up investing a lot in programming. So we do weekly community events. They're taught by repeat operators at great companies in the category. Like last week, I had my friend Matt Hodges was early at Atlassian and very early at Intercom and was most recently the head of marketing at Loom.
And so doing a 0-to-1 conversation on pricing and packaging was really great for the portfolio. Like, we spent 90 minutes unpacking every aspect of what needs to happen next, just because I find in this environment, many companies are starting with a handful of design partners, and it's very much finding creative ways to get consistent feedback from a handful of really smart early users. The challenge with that model is, you know, you have to find repeatability, and you do sometimes run the risk of optimizing for the needs of a handful of customers. And so we walked through various different business models and how companies can think about pricing and packaging post-close beta, and when you start to actually unleash the product into the wild, which is really fun. As far as like the day-to-day of me as a solo capitalist, I spend about 40% of my week on recruiting. It's all hands on deck. I mean, if I look at a company like Hopin, you know, when I invested in a Hopin, they were a team of four people. They're now a team of over 400 people, and it's continuing to grow and scale. And so, you know, while they have a lot of big names and big firms on the cap table, it's an all hands on deck situation. And what I've recognized very early in venture is that every connection and every relationship that you have matters a lot, because I think when people are thinking about their next career move, they trust people that they've worked with before, or investors that they've followed on Twitter for a while, or individuals that they'd love to work with. And so I do a lot of helping candidates decide next steps. I also love helping with salary negotiation and equity compensation as well. And so that's something that I think a lot about, is how do we set someone up for success in this next role? Because, you know, I would love for them to stay in the work life orbit for the rest of their career. And so if I can build that relationship or sooner rather than later, get to know them, get to know their long-term career goals. Many of the recent hires that have joined work-life portfolio companies, they want to start a company in the next 5 years. And so the question there is, how do I help them get as much exposure across the business and get actively involved in certain aspects of company building, knowing that their desire is to leave and ultimately start something? I also find, I mean, on the day-to-day, what's interesting, and I know a lot of investors talk about, you know, venture as being a little bit more of like a lone wolf experience. I think it is very different because the teams are naturally smaller. It's not like joining a high growth startup where team size is doubling, or, you know, you're going to have a massive org. But what I do love about venture is I do block percentage of my week for just what I call working my outbox. And so I like to stay in touch with people. So I stay in touch with previous managers. I stay in touch with, you know, engineers that I've worked with along the way. One thing that I love doing that's been super helpful from a sourcing standpoint is maintaining lists of, you know, the first 25 to 50 builders at companies in our category. You know, whether it's product designers or engineers or first ops hires, like that's where a lot of our community programming actually comes into play, is that not only are we inviting great operators that are in the work-life ecosystem, I'm also inviting early career operators that can learn from someone like Matt, who has been at now three great companies in our category and has just a wealth of knowledge. And so I do really make a conscious effort and allocate the right amount of time to make sure we're inviting early career operators to everything that we're doing as well.
Amazing. You know, Brianne, you're in so many awesome companies. You mentioned Hopin, you mentioned Webflow. You're also in Pipe and Public and which we are co-investors in. I'm curious, like, talk a little bit more for our, you know, angel investors or our aspiring solo GPs out there. How do you source such incredible deals, and how are you able to win allocation in these deals? It's such a competitive market right now.
The thing that I've found that's been most effective is leaning into strengths. You know, I remember when I was thinking about getting into venture, thinking about doing venture full time, you know, I was previously at Zendesk. At the time, was building Zendesk for startups. So I had some great visibility and was spending a lot of time with different incubators, accelerators, other VCs. Like, I felt like that was such a great way to build my network. You know, a lot of mentors had encouraged me to be sector agnostic, first of all, and also potentially stage agnostic as well. I've found over time there are so many different ways of doing venture or, you know, building an angel portfolio. For the work-life model to work, it's really important for us to make sure that we're involved in like the best companies in our category. And so I find that that list can be pretty limited, actually. I don't feel as much pressure to invest in every pre-seed company or to necessarily go too far outside the thesis, just because there are so many companies being built right now. The thing that I kept in mind when I was an operator and was writing angel checks on the side is I maintained a list of companies that I really loved the product, loved the team, loved the culture. And so that's where like Webflow came about. I was using it at Zendesk. I really admired both co-founders and loved the culture that they were building. I've always taken more of a community first approach to how I think about investing. So it's finding ways to add value. You know, at the time, Mariah Driver, who's now the head of diversity and inclusion, she was actually doing that work on evenings and weekends. So she was in a different role at the company. She was very passionate about D&I. I had connected her to my friend Aubrey, who's the head of D&I at Atlassian at the time. And so just found ways to connect the dots, bearing in mind that I was mostly doing this on evenings and weekends. Mm-hmm. And so finding time to get people together in a group format was something that was super helpful as far as scaling my time. That's been true. I run a program once a quarter. Well, now we're doing a mix of weekly community events online, but then we'll do in-person quarterly events called SaaS School. And the vision there was just pulling together great executives in my network. And selfishly, like these were individuals that I would love to work with, like friends that were early at Airtable and Drift and now Postman and Figma and Notion. It's like we've all been in the Bay Area for a while. The interesting thing about the Bay Area is there's just so many people that you would love to work with. Like you think in a very similar way. You know, you would love to work with them directly at some point in time, but it's always like trying to align the timeline and making that happen can be really complicated. And so I found SaaS School was a really nice way for friends that I used to grab dinner with, and we'd compare notes on, you know, like growth ideas. Or at the time when I was building Zendesk for Startups, I had a dinner with all of the startup leads at other tech companies. It's been nice to find ways just to work with people in a really collaborative way. And so I find that a lot of like online education is a good way of doing that. I mean, this podcast is also a great example of doing that as well. So for me, it's always been finding ways to connect the dots and identifying problems that I'd love to work on or problems that are still largely unsolved. I mean, Hopin is a great example where Hopin was started before COVID. However, you know, immediately was in a very strong position at the start of the pandemic because they had done a lot of the hard work first. So the technology was in a really good position. They had brought on board a few critical hires on the go-to-market side. So they were ready to sell to large events and enterprise companies. And in the very early days looked very different because they were solving the hardest problem first, which was having a really strong sales team and having a go-to-market motion where they could not just start, you know, more bottom up with happy hours and internal events, but they were selling to really large scale conferences. And so the Hopin investment actually came out of being a conference speaker on a few Hopin events and realizing how great the technology was and seeing some of the features that were really smart. In the example of Hopin, I mean, that was more of an all hands on deck as far as who are my mutual connections with Johnny. I believe I sent him a cold DM on Twitter, tried on LinkedIn, had emailed a few CEO friends that had been hosting events on Hopin and just kept asking for intros.
Amazing.
I think I emailed at least 15 or 20 people to see if I could get an intro to Johnny and was not aware if or when he was fundraising or what the next round was going to look like, but it was the type of company that I wanted to be part of that journey. And so I find for angels, you know, there are so many shots into a company. And I think especially today, like the ecosystem is transitioning to a style of continuous fundraising where if you're an operator and you have great experience and you're down to help, founders will make room either in between rounds or there are allocations reserved for the next round. And so I find it's just putting yourself in a strong position where you've already been helpful. And
if and when they raise their next round, like you're on that list of people that have been the most helpful.
I love that. I think it was Gokul tweeted something a few months ago that has really stuck with me, where he says, hey, founders, like, reserve $500,000 of your round, like, don't allocate it, and then see which angels or which solo GPs or which smaller funds, like, step up and actually, like, help you hire. And for each hire that they help you make, like, you give them, like, some allocation. And I thought that was just, like, so, so, so smart in terms of, like, really, like, letting people prove out. Because, of course, like, when every investor is in sell mode, you're like, oh, I'm going to do the world. And then I think the reality is founders oftentimes are disappointed when people don't actually pull through.
Historically, my perception when I first started angel investing was, you know, I had oftentimes waited for founders to email me. And so when that happens, you're limited to what comes inbound. What I'm seeing today and where I get super excited is a lot of the ways that you can be helpful can be easily automated. Like, I would say a lot of the workflows that I've built behind the scenes are fairly automated, where if I catch up with a friend and an operator that's thinking about next steps, I'll email a handful of founders and say, like, give a little bit of a, you know, background on what's going on, figure out if there are any upcoming roles where they can be helpful. Like, a lot of these things can be done in more of a programmatic way. Mm-hmm. And so I oftentimes encourage friends that are thinking about angel investing, like, start laying the foundation today, like, build out the workflows for how you think about, you know, making introductions to other VCs, or what are the email templates you can write for, like, these are great people that are looking for their next role. And I think there are a lot of these things that you can start to lay the foundation before you write your first check. I oftentimes go back to the example of, the same is not true today, but, you know, back in the day when you joined a VC firm as a GP, many general partners would wait at least a year to write their first check. And so there's a lot of thoughtfulness in sort of how you approach investor team fit, investor founder fit, whatever you call it. I think it takes a little while to get into a good groove where you know what you're looking for, you know, where you've seen enough companies to have a really strong sense for, like, this is my shot. Like, this is the company that I want to put down a term sheet, that I want to play an active role in the company, that, you know, I have to get into this deal. And so I oftentimes encourage the same of angels, where whether it's, there's so much information readily available on Twitter and on Substack, like, whether it's reading examples of other investors' deal memos, whether it's starting to figure out, like, what is your strategy for helping portfolio companies with hiring? What is your strategy for, like, company building, and what are, like, the types of companies that you want to invest in? I think there's a lot of that foundational work that you can do prior to ever writing a check.
There's so many different ways to do this job. I met a growth investor who is catching up with one of the bigger firms last week and was asking her about her approach. And she said, I don't pretend to be a product person. The truth is, that's not where I get my key insights, and that's not where I differentiate. And most of the founders I work with, they're product-oriented founders. And so what I try to do is bring a pure go-to-market sales efficiency, knowledge, and expertise, and then just make sure I'm super expert on that, really familiar with the best practices, know what great looks like, have an awesome network for recruiting and building that go-to-market team. And then founders know exactly how to leverage me. And I just thought that was such a great approach, which is to say, whatever that spike or skill set you have, is you just deepen that. There's so many different ways to do the job. And, like, yeah. I think to your point too, like, the community aspect, the industry is so dynamic, and recruiting and trying to, like, have good networks is just foundational to everything we do. And our work with Hashtag Angels is, like, planting seeds. Like, every time we host a dinner, or every time we get a group together, or we syndicate a deal or whatnot, you're just sort of trying to put good people together, share what we're learning, share knowledge, and put stuff out there that, you know, in the long term that will come back. Folks that are like, oh, I want to work with them, or I know that they've got a good network. And that's where this job, I think, gets more fun over time, because that stuff starts to compound.
When we first started angel investing, so much of our deal flow came out of Twitter and Google and Netflix and like the places that we all had worked. And over the last 6 years, I feel like there's definitely been a shift. I mean, we still have like operator networks that deal flow comes out of. We have a lot of like VC friends and other angel friends and folks like you, Brianne, who sent us deal flow, which is amazing. Thank you. But now I feel like so much of our deal flow comes from all the founders we've backed, which is like the greatest testament, you know, possible of just like, okay, this is somebody who's actually like already taken money from us, has found us helpful, and now is referring us on. I think, Brianne, you coined the phrase check size to value ratio. And I just love that in that, you know, we've often heard at hashtag angels, like even though we take up a small part of the cap table, that we just outperform on helpfulness. And so I think you really coined it well.
For a second, I thought you were going to bring up the workhorses and show horses, because I got into a little bit of trouble because many show horses were disappointed because they believe that they're still workhorses.
Wait, tell me more about that one.
So I wrote this sort of in maybe like two and a half years ago. When you're first getting started as an angel, founders are looking for people that are maybe early career that are ready to really dig in and add a lot of value. And so I find that workhorses who they may be a scout for another firm, they may be writing a 5K check. The allocation itself doesn't matter. What matters is that they really care about the problem and they are likely anywhere they can deliver a lot of value. And so sometimes the way that we structure this with work-life companies is we say, let's look at the product and let's look at who we want our first 10 customers to be. Like if we want Notion, Figma, Airtable, any of these companies to be using the product, let's find someone that an active angel that can be helpful on the other side and can serve as sort of a customer angel and someone who's going to be really helpful. And the allocation doesn't matter. What matters is that we're building more of a community around what we're doing. And we have people that are bought in from the earliest stage.
Yeah. So Brianne, I'm curious, you know, as you are going from your first fund into next fund, how are you thinking about ownership and increasing allocation in deals? And what are you seeing in terms of like how you have to now compete with some of the much bigger firms on Sand Hill Road?
Yeah, it's a great question. So fund one was a $10 million fund. It was great to have a community of founders that were bought into the work-life mission, that have made introductions and helped strengthen our network when we do a lot of weekly community events and programming. Many of those operators are currently at a growth stage company and the CEO is one of my LPs. For fund two, larger check size, have reserved 40% for follow-on, which is great. The one thing that was missing from fund one and you know, it was essentially a proof of concept fund. Like that was my friends and family round. Like there were so many people that I have been dying to work with where I've respect their career as an investor or really respected the company that they've built. And so I had a lot to learn for fund one. And so first fund, I was able to write 25, 50, up to 100K checks, which is pretty friendly and easy to get on the cap table. But the goal is more, you know, $1 to $2 million checks. And then we are continuing to follow on with those reserves in place for fund two. Idea that I had in fund one, which I'm happy that I did that work up front, I would typically ask for that sized allocation anyway. However, I was gifting the allocations to founders and to LPs. And so the nice thing in doing that is you have the confidence to ask for more. And you also have, you know, I now have a year and a half of goodwill that's been built because I share a lot of SPVs or opportunities for direct investing. That said, I mean, it's very competitive right now. That's just the fact of the matter. I hear this from angels that want to write 5 to 10K checks where they also feel that it's very competitive. Like there are so many good companies being built right now and there's a lot of capital in the ecosystem. And so I find that having a very clear strike zone and finding, mapping out the sectors that I'm really excited about has been one way to navigate this crazy environment. If I felt like I was constantly chasing deals, I think quite frankly, I would be so burnt out and exhausted where it's been nice to know which companies to jump on or which ones to really like do a lot of the work up front. Fun fact, I mean, I did an analysis of Fund One, and on average, I'm spending about 6 months with teams before I write a check. You know, a lot of these things can be done programmatically, where it is like making introductions to potential customers, or it's giving them a heads up of like, these are 10 people that are looking to join a seed stage company, or there are things that you can do in a fairly fast fashion. However, there aren't any shortcuts. It's a bit of an always on job. And so I find that the best investors, they truly love what they do, and it is always on thing. But so far, it's been really fun. I mean, I would say while it is very competitive, I also find that the startup is designed for people to be helpful. And so I've had situations previously where, you know, maybe someone pushes you out of an investment, or, you know, they need a larger allocation, but they'll be the first to send you more deal flow in the future. And so I find it is the type of ecosystem where it is competitive, but you do find ways to like still be friends and still find ways to work together over time.
Yeah. And to me, I think it just all evidence of this broader theme of there's more capital and more different sources of capital that wants to make its way into private tech. And ultimately, that's creating a more liquid market. It's creating more options for founders. It's creating a more competitive environment for investors. But I think so long as there are really visible big wins in private stage tech, like my guess is we'll continue to see this. And ultimately, I think it's good for the ecosystem, even though, you know, personally speaking as an investor, it is one more like competitive dynamic that you have to figure out. I think it's a natural path as like the private markets mature, basically. Rian, one thing I'd love to ask as we wrap up, we try to highlight other folks in the ecosystem who kind of pay it forward or are those folks who are planting those seeds or just providing goodwill and doing awesome stuff that we feel like people should know about. Are there other people you admire or folks that you just want to give a shout out to that you think are doing good things in the industry or have been helpful to you that we could highlight?
So I'm not sure if you've met Paige Daughtry yet, but Paige had sent me a cold email a little over a year ago, was very interested in getting into venture capital. She is based in San Diego, so outside the Bay Area, sent me a cold email and was thinking about next steps career-wise, very interested in learning more about venture. The things that we work on evenings and weekends are the things that we love doing are ultimately, you know, the things that we should be doing during the day. And so Paige is building an amazing career at WorkOS, portfolio company and angel investment. She also recently wrote a book on venture capital, which I'm super excited about. She wrote a book called Seed to Harvest, and it's a simple explanation of venture capital. And so I'm very excited about the work that Paige is doing specifically for women and underrepresented groups in tech. You know, it's not something that's taught in school. It's not something that is easy to really understand how it works unless you're on the inside. And so Paige has done a really great job of creating a book that's very easy to understand and one that I hope kids and even non-kids, people that want to break into VC should check out the book.
Rian, thank you so much for joining us today. This is such a delight to catch up and to see your face at least on screen for a little bit. But we are just so proud of what you've built with WorkLife. And we just think it's one of the most interesting kind of new games, new models in town as it comes to venture. So congrats on all of the success and can't wait to see what you do here over the next few years.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you, Rian.
That's a wrap. Thank you for listening. To keep with Brianne, you can follow her on Twitter at Brianne Kimmel. Next up on the pod, we sit down with Rachel Horowitz, comms executive who has led teams at Twitter, Facebook, Coinbase, and Google. If you're enjoying the pod, please give us a rating or leave us a review. It helps people discover us. Or talk to us on Twitter. We're at #angels. The Hashtag Angels podcast is a production of H Industries. The episode was produced and edited by Edit Audio, and our theme music was composed by Toby Forsman of Whipsong Music. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.